carry. Please.
Thank you, Judge Wood, and may it please the court. The Supreme Court's decision in LaRue is in many ways a game-changing decision. The court there held that the distinction between defined contribution and defined benefit plans, a distinction that runs throughout the ERISA statute, has significant consequences for the ability of plan participants to sue for breach of fiduciary duty under Section 502A2. And those consequences we submit, Your Honors, include the ability of district courts to certify these cases as class actions under Rule 23. The distinction the court drew in LaRue is this. A participant in a defined benefit plan only has an interest in the plan as a whole. He must sue, if at all, on behalf of the entire plan. The common interest shared by all participants, the Supreme Court said in the Russell case, is in the financial integrity of the plan. A defined contribution plan is very different. There, each participant has an interest only in the assets allocated to that participant's own account. In the LaRue case.
I'm looking at LaRue, and LaRue is a bit Delphic about some points. It says, for defined contribution plans, this is around 256, fiduciary misconduct need not threaten the solvency of the entire plan, et cetera. And so it addresses the language about entire plan from Russell. But it seems to me it's possible to read, or maybe one should read LaRue as saying that you can have an interest only in, let's say, your undivided part of the plan, or maybe the plan as a whole. I mean, there might be a couple of levels that LaRue is recognizing.
Your Honor, the most important thing that LaRue said is that the entire plan language from Russell does not apply, and in fact is beside the point.
Beside the point is the word.
It says both of those things. It does not apply. It is beside the point in the context of defined contribution plans. Your question has within it, Judge Wood, is it possible in a defined contribution plan that some breach could possibly affect all plan participants in a defined benefit way, in a Russell way? And I think the answer is it is possible, given the almost infinite variety of structures that plan sponsors can give to ERISA plans. It is conceivable that there is such a claim. However,
And I thought your colleague, who I thought you were at first, Mr. Braden, said in his brief that, for example, if every single participant in a defined contribution plan has to pay 17 basis points as an administrative fee, for example, and that's just the price of admission to the entire process, that might be that kind of general across-the-board sort of claim.
I'll let Mr. Braden speak for his claim, but it certainly is possible that a fee, a uniform fee, might be that kind of a case. There is no such fee in the Boeing case challenged by these plaintiffs in the Boeing case. The only fee challenge that remains in the Boeing case is to the revenue-sharing component, which was only in certain of the investment options. Nothing goes
that
across the board.
That was inside that was the fee, each particular.
Correct, Your Honor. I mean, one way to think about your question is there are certain claims of fiduciary duty that run vertically through the plan, individual investment options, that only apply to those participants that invest in those options. Other claims could apply horizontally across the plan. In the Boeing case, the five claims that remain in the Boeing case are all vertical claims. They are all plan option specific claims. None of them even pretends to cut horizontally across the plan in that way. So the short answer to your question is, by delinking the plan as a whole from the plan participants' accounts in LaRue, I think the court made clear that both kinds of plans were possible. In fact, in that same passage that the court referred to, the court said, whether a fiduciary breach diminishes plan assets payable to all participants or only to persons tied to particular accounts, it presents the issues raised by 409. That gives the court then the opportunity and the challenge to determine which kind of a claim the plaintiffs are bringing in a particular case, and if it's the latter, that is, it is a challenge that only affects certain participants in their own accounts, then the kind of wall-to-wall, start-to-finish, mandatory automatic class certification that these plaintiffs proposed and the district court accepted, just doesn't apply.
So what about this claim that runs through these cases, that one of the problems has to do with the original selection of investment vehicles for the plan?
Your Honor, in the Boeing case...
an across-the-board issue.
With respect, Your Honor, it's not, at least not in the Boeing case. For example, the plaintiffs claim that the selection of the technology fund within the Boeing plan was imprudent.
Right.
Only a third of plan participants ever invested in the technology fund. It held less than a 10% of the plan assets. So that for two-thirds of the plan participants, they don't even have standing to challenge that decision.
That would suggest the possibility of subclass or of a different class definition. Then you could say all persons in the Boeing plan who selected the technology fund
and who lost money, Your Honor, because Section 409 requires a loss to the plan as manifested through the individual account. There is, in this case, the plaintiffs have insisted on, as I said, a wall-to-wall, start-to-finish class. They haven't ever proposed subclasses. We are responding to the class they proposed and that the court certified.
But what about wondering, you know, if you're a plan participant and you sit down, now you're working for Boeing and you're able to make this choice, and you look at the array of choices available to you, you're saying that if you don't happen to choose the technology plan, you're not affected by the fact that that's in the mix?
Absolutely right, Your Honor. And that's the holding of the Second Circuit in the Kendall case. That's the holding of the Ninth Circuit in the Glanton case. Implicit in the holding of the Eighth Circuit in the Braden case. Every case that has considered that question has come out and said that where the challenge is to the prudence of the selection or the continued offering of the plan option, the named plaintiff has to invest in that option. And the corollary under LaRue is the persons who haven't invested in that option aren't affected by it. And in this case...
What if the person, though, is just kind of taking the lesser of a number of evils? You know, there's the technology plan, and it looks terrible, or whatever. Maybe it's a great plan. I don't know. But... I don't know. It seems to me that the mix of what's being presented to you could have a subtle influence on your choice, regardless of what these other courts have said.
Your Honor, as the court is well aware from Hecker and otherwise, the plan sponsor and then the plan administrators have tremendous flexibility in the number of options to offer, which may change over time. And the plaintiffs in the Boeing case have made no suggestion that there were too few options or that the overall range wasn't sufficiently diverse. You know, the kind of challenge the court is positing, I think, would have to be brought within an overall challenge to insufficient diversification so that the offering of any one option magnifies that problem. Here, the overall plan is concededly sufficiently diverse. The only question is the selection of options within that plan, which then affects only those participants who made that option. And again, to return, if I could, to the question of subclassing, that is a concept, that is a 23B3 concept. That is not a 23B1 concept.
Right.
The Boeing submission here is not, Your Honors, as the plaintiffs and as Department of Labor caricature it, that there can be no ERISA class actions. It is that in the defined contribution context, Rule 23B1B, the mandatory, automatic, no-notice, no-opt-out provision, doesn't fit after LaRue.
Well, at least it doesn't fit what you're calling the vertical cases. It seems to me it would probably be a pretty decent fit for the horizontal ones.
Your Honor, in the Boeing case, we only have vertical challenges.
Right.
And I've looked at all the 16 cases brought by the Schlichter firm, and they all look to me to involve vertical challenges.
Oh.
But as I said, the plan design is so varied. One of the beauties of the ERISA statute is allowing different employers to set things up different ways. If the plaintiffs came in with a true horizontal challenge and could show that it fit within B1B, we're not saying that could be ruled out. But again, I would remind the court, B1B creates tremendous due process problems because these are damages claims with no opt-out rights for the absent class members. B3 is the available alternative, heightened protections for the absent class members, heightened showing for the plaintiffs. It's the plaintiff's burden to show which provision of Rule 23B is required.
Right. Well, I mean, B1B, I mean, I'm going to take a little bit of exception that has due process problems. If you really truly have, you know, a common fund and you've got the kinds of things that B1B was written for, then there is a necessary representativeness for whoever it is who brings the case. They're going to dispose of everybody's claims whether they like it or not. And actually, there was a little bit of that in B2. Since once the injunction is entered, presumably the injunction is entered. So the opt-out concept just doesn't work too well. It's more when you get to the individualized claims and damages and all the rest of it that you that you need the extra protections for B3.
And what the court said in Ortiz is, for exactly that reason, the courts need to be vigilant and make sure
right.
that the mandatory cases truly do fit within the historical precedents. And our submission is that LaRue shows that the line drawn in LaRue, in general, between defined benefit plans on the one side and defined contribution plans on the other, maps exactly to the pre-1966 trust world, where some trust claims, which common and undivided interest, this court's decision in Boesenberg, that's a defined benefit claim, and a particularized or divided interest, a typical family trust that gives different allocations to each child, would be on the defined contribution side.
But what about the argument that this is actually all a lot of accounting? You know, if a company like Boeing has its defined contribution plan, it actually has a giant pool of assets that it's managing, and each person may have a particularized claim to those assets, but you don't have millions of different little trust accounts for people.
Your Honor,
in common fund.
Two answers. First is, it's not just accounting, it's required by the statute. Section 1002 sub 34 requires allocation from the start to the finish of each asset to an individual's account. So there is no slush fund, if you will. It's all allocated at all times. Second,
well, you keep it straight, just like a bank would keep straight. If I had a checking account, they can't give my money to somebody else.
That goes to my second answer, which is right. Section 1003 requires the plan assets to be held in trust that is segregated from the employer's assets.
Right.
ERISA would allow 189,000 separate trusts. It would be an administrative nightmare for the administrator, but nothing requires it to be held in one trust. What the allocation rule says, if you hold it in a master trust or an aggregated trust, then you must allocate it. But what LaRue says is, the fact that you must allocate it means that each individual then has an interest only in those assets. And if the court would think for a second about the former participant claims, this court's decision in Harzewski, the Fourth Circuit's decision in the mutual funds case, they only have standing. They can only pursue their claims because they retain that individualized interest in their own account. They've cashed out of the plan. They can't have a common and undivided interest in the plan as a whole within the meaning of this court's decision in Boesenberg or the Citizens Banking case, the pre-1966 B1B cases. They've got an individualized issue. And again, that's a B3 problem. It creates predominance and superiority problems, but it's a problem that needs to be dealt with in a different way than the district court did in this case and that the plaintiffs are suggesting. If I could reserve the balance of my time.
Yeah, he's
thank you, Your Honor.
Reserve. Okay. And Mr. Mollica.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Luckily, you're arguing both of these cases, so my cards are...
You'll see me again. And I have the honor of having divided argument this morning with the Secretary, represented by Mr. Silverman at the council table, if it please the court. There is one certainty in the case here and also international paper. Both cases are going to proceed to judgment at some point. And the question presented to the court essentially in this case is who beyond the immediate litigants are going to be bound by that outcome?
And can we start with this class definition you have? Because I'm looking, this happens to be the Spano brief, but it's basically the same in the international paper case. All persons who are or were participants or beneficiaries, who are, were, or may have been affected, as well as those who will become participants or beneficiaries in the future, that's an incredibly broad definition. I have no idea who's in that class.
Well, customarily in cases involving injunctive or declaratory relief, the definition might be broad to cover incidents, for instance, future participants or future beneficiaries.
So if somebody 10 years from now, in your view, goes to work for Boeing and you've prevailed, you would have to say to that person, you can't really bring any claim about the defined contribution plan because that's already been decided and it's res judicata against you?
You can't bring these particular claims as to the state of the fund when the complaint was filed. That's true.
Right. So, I mean, that strikes me as a very expansive ruling. It's not like saying, you know, don't discriminate on the basis of race, you know, a classic B2 sort of claim. And it's quite different even from saying in the defined benefit kind of context that you've got to observe certain fiduciary responsibilities.
Well, I think on any remand of this, the definition could either be altered or, as you suggested, Your Honor, one of your earlier questions, some subclassing could be taking place.
I think this definition is, if there's a class action at all, I think that this definition doesn't capture what the rules contemplate in class certification. Now, I think there may be some common issue. I'd be very interested in what you see as the common issues that affect everybody in this alleged class.
Well, we were talking, or counsel was talking earlier about vertical versus horizontal, but all of that is predicated on a notion that LaRue creates individual causes of action that are actionable under 502A2 that are owned essentially by the participant. It's true that LaRue expanded the number of claims that could be brought by individuals for unique injuries to their own part of the plan, their own assets. But it did not eliminate the fact that the claims belong to the plan. They are on behalf of the plan.
But you see, I've had trouble understanding that. I mean, it looking at the language of LaRue, which says, you know, whether a fiduciary breach diminishes plan assets or only payable to all participants or only to persons tied to particular individual accounts. Okay, so what I am imagining that means is that you do have this kind of master trust, and you've got somebody who's bringing a claim that focuses only on that portion of the master trust, which is a matter of law and is a matter of everything else is allocated to that person. Whether we call that for the plan or whether we call that for the individual seems to me a little bit artificial. It really is an individual claim. I don't see what's happening here on a plan-wide basis in the same way, say, the International Paper claim about the 17 basis points. That I easily see. That applies to everybody who's in the plan. So it just doesn't strike me as a plan-wide, unless you're going to say all plans shall be forbidden to have employee stock option accounts in them. All right, that would be a plan-wide thing. You just can't have them, period.
Well, I think you put your finger on it, Your Honor. There are some practices that would be common because as these are claims that are brought on behalf of the plan, essentially the plan participant is stepping into the shoes of the fiduciary who would ordinarily bring these claims.
So why is this a fiduciary care, though, about the fact that one particular participant has invested, say, in stock, Boeing stock, for example, or a high-tech fund or what have you, and other participants haven't? Why is that a plan concern, unless there's something about the selection of options for the plan?
Well, for one, because there's been a loss to the plan as a whole.
In what sense? I mean, the people who are investing in the high-tech fund aren't going to have a portfolio that's worth as much. But it doesn't hurt people who didn't invest in that. They're still going to, maybe they invested in some highly successful mutual fund or whatever.
What the fiduciary bringing the suit would be arguing was that the introduction of a single sector fund, for instance, injured the plan as a whole.
Well, how does it, I just understand that. How does it injure the plan as a whole if maybe the overall amount of assets in the plan as a whole aren't as great as if that fund had worked, but maybe some other part of it did better? And why does the plan as a whole have an interest in the overall size of its asset pool?
It has an interest in the options that are being offered to the participants.
So it doesn't have an interest in the overall size of its asset pool?
Doesn't, no.
It doesn't, because those are all individually allocated to the different participant accounts.
Well, it certainly has an interest in maximizing outcomes for all of its participants. So a fund that is clearly imprudent, for instance, a retail mutual fund where a wholesale fund would have been less expensive, would pertain to everybody.
Well, Why does the fund have an – I mean, this actually takes us back to some things that were discussed in Hecker. Why does the fund have any duty other than full disclosure of the costs of this mutual fund, retail versus wholesale, other than to make sure that people know what those costs are? Maybe they're offering more services for the same dollars.
Well, that's right. That would be a merits issue, ultimately, would be the question of whether the costs were reasonable or unreasonable. But that would apply overall to anybody who was investing in those funds. Some of these.
So how much is a reason? Do you want the courts to be price fixers? I mean, I don't know what the reasonable rate is for.
Well, here, Your Honor, there was a process question as well. There was evidence in the record that they were aware that they were, in some instances, being overcharged for services.
Participants were of the opinion that they were being
No, no, Your Honor.
Fiduciaries were of the opinion that various.
There were and there was a delay in renegotiating and bringing that down in line. Expending costs uselessly would be a breach of fiduciary duty.
How quickly are they supposed to respond?
Well, in this case, it was there were years that went by. The issue about whether this should be a B1B versus any other kind of class is that each individual participant has an interest, for instance, in the decision about whether there will be a technology fund or whether there will be a company stock fund.
Mr. Perry didn't think that anybody who didn't want to invest in the technology fund did have an interest in that, that if there was going to be a class, let's say, I mean, I'm not saying he conceded this, but the only kind of class one might imagine would be one focused on the inclusion of a particular fund.
You have participants in the plan who may have an interest in investing in the technology fund and others who do not. You want a single court to determine the suitability of the technology fund. You could not have or should not have two courts entering injunctions that direct the fiduciary both to allow it and to abate it.
Why does the technology fund's existence hurt somebody who doesn't want to direct his or her dollars that way?
It hurts the plan. It hurts the overall assets.
But how so? It would a different technology fund have been the better choice? I don't understand what you're saying.
It over-concentrated the investments into a single sector. That was the claim.
How does that affect someone who has not invested in that sector?
It affects the plan, and the plan is the entity that owns the claim under LaRue and under 502A2.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And Mr. Silverman, you are arguing now.
May it please the Court, my name is Stephen Silverman on behalf of the Secretary of Labor. The Department's primary interest in this case is to ensure that the Supreme Court's LaRue decision is correctly interpreted and applied. The Supreme Court held in LaRue that an ERISA Section 502A2 claim brought by a participant in a defined contribution plan can only be a plan claim for the recovery of plan losses. That holding is consistent with the district court's conclusion below and lays the foundation for resolving most of the class certification issues raised by the defendants in the plaintiff's favor.
So I would like more detail in this concept that the participant in a defined contribution case who wants to complain perhaps about the fees associated with one of the funds or about the fact that it's in a risky sector or whatever the complaint may be about one of the funds that participant wants to invest in. In what sense, in your view or in the Secretary's view, is this on behalf of the plan if, as Mr. Perry argues, by law, even if there is, just like a bank has a big bundle of money, it's actually allocated specifically to each individual.
Well, Mr. Perry's argument is premised on individualizing the claims. The claim does not belong to the individual. It belongs to the plan.
Why? I mean, that's just a definitional thing you're saying. Why, when somebody brings a defined contribution claim like the ones being offered here, and I don't mean to say the ones either about selection of what package of investments will be offered to participants, and I don't want to discuss something like this across-the-board fee. Those, I understand, certainly deal with the plan as a whole. But why do these individual things relate to the plan rather than the individual person in a way that would be suitable for class action treatment? Now, of course, the Supreme Court in LaRue isn't looking at that. The Supreme Court in LaRue is looking at this particular participant in the 401k.
Yes. Well, and I would point to the holding in LaRue that says that we therefore hold that although 502A2 does not provide a remedy for individual injuries distinct from plan injuries, that provision does authorize recovery for fiduciary breaches that impair the value of plan assets.
Plan assets in a participant's individual account. And
that impair the value of plan assets, right, in a participant's individual account. But the first part of that makes clear that there's no remedy for individual injury distinct from plan injury.
Well, isn't the court saying that that the individual injuries are the plan injuries, are the individual injuries? They're all one and the same thing. But it doesn't mean that they aren't, if you will, individualized. And if they are individualized, is that the kind of thing that's suitable for class treatment? In what sense would the plan be enriched if one individual does better with one fund and another individual does better with another fund, when one individual's success isn't going to increase the recovery for somebody else?
Well, a defined contribution plan is not simply a collection of individualized, separate, and unrelated accounts. ERISA Section 403A provides that all those assets must be held in a common trust. Therefore, an injury to the plan assets held in the individual account of any plan participant is also an injury to the plan.
Which is why I can see, as I say, I mean, I certainly wouldn't say there are no class actions at all possible in this world, but if that common trust is lodged somewhere, you know, maybe there's, you know, it's Fidelity, it's Chase, it's somebody, and the trust as a whole is paying, an anti-competitively high fee, maybe there's been price fixing among the holders of trusts or something, surely that does diminish the pool of assets as a whole, and maybe that filters down to each individual. But I'm having trouble seeing which kinds of concrete examples that affect the plan assets as a whole for a defined contribution plan would be the kinds of things that an individual could complain about.
Well, Your Honor, it's not the Department's position that every single 502A2 claim can be brought as a class action suit. For example, LaRue was not a class action suit and very likely would not have satisfied the 23A requirements. So,
right, and so in some ways we're all together. I mean, I think what we're talking about is the middle. We all agree that there are going to be some class actions. We all agree that it's not always going to be a class action. So the question that would be helpful from the Secretary is, which kinds of cases are suitable for class action treatment, in your view?
Well, two responses. First of all, the Secretary's primary interest is ensuring that the Secretary does not have a particular interest in class certification. The issue is that the defendants have argued that LaRue bars class certifications in the 502A2 context. And that the Secretary's interest is ensuring that LaRue is correctly interpreted. Now, as to whether or not a 502A2 claim is appropriate for class certification, we would go through the Rule 23A factors and Rule 23B. So that's a class certification issue, not an ERISA issue. And certainly, LaRue does not provide a basis for disallowing class certification under Rule 23B, under Rule 23, as the defendants are asserting. The result in LaRue was really a foregone conclusion based on the court's own precedent in Massachusetts Mutual Life Insurance versus Russell. There, the court explained that the fiduciary duties imposed by Section 409A, which Section 502A2 enforces, results in the plan being the victim of any breach and the recipient of any resulting losses. Russell itself relied heavily on the language of a statute which conclusively resolved this issue. Section 502A2 allows a participant to bring a civil action for appropriate relief for violations of Section 409A.
But you would imagine that this relief, should the case go forward, doesn't get paid to the plaintiff. The relief gets paid to the plan, and then somehow the plaintiff gets a better deal from its participation?
If
the plaintiff is suing on behalf of the plan, I don't see how the plaintiff obtains the relief directly.
The plaintiff is suing on behalf of the plan. The relief would be ordered to the plan. The plaintiff's allegation in this case, relates to the defendant's single course of conduct toward the defined contribution plan. Any liability on the part of the defendant will be relative to the plans, not relative to any individual accounts within the plan.
And so the defendant's course of conduct vis-a-vis the plan, the defendant only does a few things vis-a-vis the plan. The defendant decides what investment vehicles will be in the plan. You know, will there be 9? Will there be 100? Will there be a brokerage window? Will there be whatever there may be? The defendant has some probably review process, you know, revisiting that question from time to time. The defendant may decide, or the plan administrators may decide, what to charge at a plan-wide level. And I actually see the individual charges in the different investment vehicles as being part of that selection process. But maybe that's not the way everybody sees it. But it seems to me there are only a certain number of things that happen at the plan level.
Certainly. I mean, for example, the LaRue decision is an example of something that did not apply at the plan level per se. Certain things are occurring to the plan, and certain things are more individualized, but that does not prevent the individual or the plaintiff in this case from bringing that claim on behalf of the plan. And your concerns regarding what the line is between class certification and not class certification, these are not present in this case. This case was properly certified under Rule 23A. And Rule 20.
Class definition? I can't believe you're defending that class definition.
Well, under Rule 23 and 23A requirements and Rule 23B1B, we believe the 502A2 action are precisely or specifically identified as the type of actions that are appropriate for 23B1B certification. And so the district court's decision below, the class certification issue in this case is really should not be a concern to the court with respect to where the line is for 502A2 individual claim and plan claims being appropriate for class certification. The Secretary respectfully requests that this court affirm the decision below. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And I understand that your argument pertains both to Beasley and to Spano. So, thank you.
Your Honors, the Secretary of Labor doesn't have to proceed under Rule 23 and has no expertise in Rule 23, and I think Mr. Silverman just demonstrated the lack of understanding of how Rule 23 works. Boeing does not claim that there cannot be a class action. Boeing claims that any class action has to proceed rigorously, as the Supreme Court said in Falcone, through each of the provisions, Rule 23A, 23B, and 23C. The plaintiffs do claim that every single 502A2 claim has to be certified under Rule 23B1B.
I think that's a little unfair myself. I think they see this as a case where, as I understand it, there are structural issues with the selection of the investment vehicles, and that there are cost issues. Now, whether you agree with them or not, obviously you have your view, but I think they believe that there are at least common problems in this case, whether it goes to the plan assets or not. I mean, you've heard me say I have some concerns about that. But
Judge Wood, let me point you to page 15 of the red brief, where the plaintiffs say, because any action under 502A2 is an action for relief to the plan, it can be certified under 23B1B, period. There's no qualification in that sentence. And Judge Wood, you asked Mr. Mollica to come up with what I called a horizontal challenge in the Boeing case. He wasn't able to do it. There is no horizontal challenge in the Boeing case. These are all vertical challenges. That takes us out of B1B. Any class action has to go through Rule 23B3 with a proper class definition, scrutinized under 23A, none of which has happened in this case. The plaintiffs have stuck to their guns, wall to wall, start to finish class. You know, the court would be well justified by hanging them on that decision and saying that this class can't be certified. I mean, the future class members alone violates AmChem. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I understand what you're saying, but on the other hand, we are bound to implement the Supreme Court's LaRue decision to the best of our ability. And there's language in LaRue, which Mr. Silverman quoted, saying that 502A2 authorizes recovery for fiduciary breaches that impair the value of plan assets in a participant's individual account. So what are we to make of that?
Your Honor,
it's our obligation to do something with that.
Under Section 100234, which is the definition of an individual account plan, plan assets equal participant account assets in a defined contribution plan. That is the congressional determination. That's what the Supreme Court was enforcing in LaRue. That's what this court enforced in the Harzewski case by saying that that former participant retained an interest in his individual account. That all has to flow through the plan. There's absolutely no dispute on that. That is a canard that this side of the room has raised. These are plan assets, but there are no plan assets outside the individual accounts in a defined contribution plan. There is no other category of assets. Every asset in that trust has to be allocated from the get-go to the end of the day into an individual participant's account. That's what takes this out of the traditional B1B class action. There are no common and undivided interests in the plan. And I think Mr. Mollica conceded that when he couldn't answer Judge Tinder's question about what the injury to the plan was if the tech fund, you know, for the people that didn't invest in the tech fund. Again, it's the wrong analysis. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll take this case.